It is time, though, for my first guest this afternoon. He's Adam Levick. He's editor of Camera UK. Camera standing for the Committee for Accuracy in the Middle East Reporting and Analysis. Adam Levick, thank you so much for being with us on Chai FM.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Adam, the reason that we initiated this conversation with you this afternoon was an apology published by the Financial Times in the United Kingdom, talking about the number of buildings having been destroyed in Gaza. I think it's safe to say that thanks to your organization, the apology was obtained from the FT. But the discussion that I want to have you with you this afternoon is bigger than that. What I want to know is, why are major outlets repeatedly missing basic factual details when reporting on Gaza? What's going on in the newsroom?
Look, to some degree, there's an echo chamber, right? There's within the mainstream media, within the legacy media outlets that we monitor, there seems to be a kind of monocausal explanation that they believe is the cause for most of the problems in the Middle East, and that cause is Israel. And that's something that, you know, without getting into a psychological investigation of the individual journalists who we don't know, you know, we found, and most shockingly, that even after October 7th, even after the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, that none of these, almost none of these major media outlets kind of engaged in a period of reflection or self-examination. You'd think that after that atrocity, there would be some, you know, second guessing, some thought about whether or not they've missed the main story, which in our view is anti-Semitism that is embedded within the Palestinian society and within the broader Arab world. So, you know, it would take a much longer answer to say why there's this echo chamber, but I think, you know, they start from the position of this kind of, you know, the David versus Goliath, and that informs most of their coverage. A lot of the reports are conclusions in search of evidence instead of, you know, anything resembling real reporting. And I think it's really disconcerting, and it's really problematic for news consumers, because they're really getting a consistently skewed view, not just of the October 7th war, but of the region in general, ignoring the fact that the war on October 7th wouldn't have been possible without Iranian support, that the regional war, which involved, as you know, not just Hamas, but Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and various militias in Iraq, you know, wouldn't have been made possible without Iranian backing. And those groups are, in fact, all proxies of Iran. So, you know, it, within their kind of, you know, very narrow belief that Israel's behavior is the cause of most of the problems in the Middle East, they missed the fact that the most malign actor is Iran. I think we've seen that played out from October 7th, before October 7th, and to this very day.
I hear you. I'm just wondering if there ever was a time when reporting on Israel was in any way impartial, or if it's always been agenda driven. I know that's a loaded question, and I'm certainly coming from it thinking that it has always been agenda driven. Do you think there ever was a time when Israel got a fairer shot from the established mainstream media?
Yeah, you know, a lot of, you know, Camera's work goes back to Camera's organization. We go back to 1982. 1982, of course, was the first Lebanon war. And that's when activists within the U.S. that started Camera began to see the shift from, you know, what was previously, at least maybe through a good part of the 1970s, positive coverage of Israel, seeing Israel as the, you know, David and not the Goliath. And seeing, you know, framing the Arabs as the main instigator of the conflict, it began to change. And I think there's lots of kind of, you know, people far brighter than I am can kind of give a good intellectual analysis of that. I mean, if you go back to Edward Said, a very influential Palestinian academic in the U.S., yeah, you know, wrote a book called Orientalism. There's a lot of intellectual reasons, but I think, you know, it's almost like this, you know, if you see the world as a battle between the oppressed and the oppressor, which I think many mainstream outlets are influenced by that incredibly narrow paradigm. Then once Israel became much stronger militarily, as they did in the 80s, 90s, and into the 2000s, then their view of, who they should be rooting for, even though they shouldn't be rooting for anybody, but their view of who they should be rooting for would change, right? Because the Palestinians are clearly the weaker party,
Sure,
and that's,
sure.
simplistic. So I think it's a failure of their collective understanding of what it means to be a victim and what it means to be oppressor. And again, I jump back to October 7th when, obviously, despite the fact that Israel is much stronger than Hamas, Hamas was able to engage in a barbaric slaughter of 1,200 and take 250 hostage and engage in the most brutal pogrom, again, since the Holocaust. And that still wasn't able to kind of reconfigure the whole question of what it means to be an oppressor and the oppressed. So I think it's a failure of their kind of like collective imagination, a failure of their understanding of what it means to be a journalist, and just their understanding of what it means to be a victim.
I think you're spot on. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about somebody like Matti Friedman, who one can hear prolifically on various podcasts, who talks about the fact that when he worked in very, very significant news houses prior to moving to Israel, there was an agenda, there was a stated agenda, and news that didn't conform to that didn't get a place. And when you then overlay, as you were saying, the current kind of understanding of power dynamics with colonialism and racism and all those issues, and Israelis are white colonialist oppressors, well, there isn't really much room for sympathy left to on the Israeli side of the story. But I want to talk to you
Right.
about I want to talk to you about sourcing, because I think that's absolutely critical. And my colleague Benji, who passed me while I was walking in to studio today, says, Simon, do you have any idea the extent to which the journalists in Gaza are actually linked to Hamas? And I just kind of looked at him. No, is my answer. I had no idea. To what extent are we faced with that issue?
Well, what we're seeing is increasing evidence from both our Arabic department and from independent researchers on X, such as Gabriel Epstein, such as Mark Zlokin, such as Salo Eisenberg, who are doing really just amazing work at increasingly determining through basically open source research and based on Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas's own admissions that a great number, a high percentage of those counted as journalists in Gaza and who were counted under the Committee to Protect Journalists list as journalists who were
Yes,
killed
this is what he's talking
weren't
about.
actually journalists. They were actually affiliated with a terrorist group. So and again, there's this one question that we often ask, if these are really independent journalists working in Gaza, if they're fearless, why don't they ever put out a story that's remotely critical of Hamas? So if they were truly journalists in the common understanding of the term, that why don't they put up anything that reveals Hamas's absconding of funds, of their torture and imprisonment of dissidents,
Sure.
of their use of human shields? Like, there's almost nothing in the way of what real journalists in Gaza would do, and that is to report critically on the government in Gaza.
I want to talk about your organization for just a moment. When you guys actually flag factual mistakes and then you point it out to those in charge, what's the kind of response you usually get? Are we talking defensive? Are we talking cooperative or just silence?
Oh, I mean, look, it depends, but certainly they are really hesitant to admit error. And in fact, even, so when they usually do respond, we have a very good relationship with media outlets. When they do respond, for instance, when the Financial Times respond, they didn't admit that they were wrong. They just said that we're willing to clarify the point. Well, it wasn't a clarification, that was it was an error. It was a statement that nearly all the buildings in Gaza were destroyed by Israeli bombing. That was just factually untrue. So we kind of find this need to save face, like they don't want to admit that they actually made a mistake. And then there's also this rally around the journalists, this feeling that for instance, there's this awful journalist in, I would say awful, just horrible by any professional standards for Sky News, Alex Crawford. And, you know, she is, and we don't use this term lightly, she's, you know, pro Hezbollah. I mean, her coverage has been pro Hamas and pro Hezbollah. And her editors don't seem to have the willingness to hold her accountable. So there's this kind of like us against them, right? Like that they're fighting this organization that's trying to hold them accountable, and they don't want to be held accountable. But having said that, we do have productive relationships with many media outlets, and we've gotten hundreds of corrections each year, and that's kind of a big part of what we do. But there is this kind of unwillingness to really admit that they made an error. They'll usually couch it in different terms.
So I want to leave it, a final question, in a kind of more positive light, if that's at all possible. I want to talk about some of the successes you've had, where by pointing out the inaccuracies, you've really had a significant impact on how a story was reported and how others have seen it. Can you give me an example or two?
Sure. So my colleague Tamar Sternthal, she monitors the wire services, and one of the wire services that she monitors is UPI. It's not really. I think they used to be more prominent, but their UPI is carried by McClatchy, right? So McClatchy is a U.S. Newspaper owner who uses UPI stories in like dozens of papers owned by McClatchy. So Tamar has been able to leverage just her ability to get corrections at UPI on issues such as Hezbollah and the degree to which that they've been responsible for inciting the war with Israel, to get McClatchy to literally retract at times dozens and dozens of articles, because like I said, McClatchy has dozens of newspapers throughout the U.S. So when they publish a UPI story, that UPI story is published by dozens of newspapers in the US. So there's been, I don't know, I've lost track, maybe six or seven times in which Tamar has leveraged a correction at UPI to get corrections at literally dozens of US newspapers. So that's kind of like a good indication of the impact of Tamar, that, we're still fighting a good fight, and it's an uphill battle, but we're not giving in, and we have some really success that we're proud of, despite the fact that it's really difficult, but the successes really do matter, and they mean a lot to us as an organization and to us as employees. And we go in each day and we fight the good fight.
Keep on fighting the good fight. On behalf of us all, Adam Levick, Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis, thanks for chatting to us here on Chai FM this afternoon.